Welcome to the Doggy Dojo. I'm your host, Susan Light, a Los Angeles-based dog trainer and behavior consultant on a quest to become worthy of the title Sensei of the Doggy Dojo. Today we're talking about long cases. And what do I mean by that? As I've shifted more into behavior consultant work, I've been working with animals with more severe behavior issues. Separation anxiety, aggression, and reactivity can take months of intervention to see meaningful improvement. No one wants to hear that there isn't a quick fix for their issue, and these issues are negatively impacting the quality of life for these animals and the families that love them. It can be very emotionally draining and expensive for these families. And remember, no one asked to have an animal with these kinds of issues, so sometimes it feels like you've been dealt a bad hand. I've invited a prominent veterinary behaviorist and educator who's worked on many long cases to give us some of his advice and encouragement. My guest today is a board-certified diplomate of the American College of Veterinary Behaviorists. His work has garnered him international recognition as a thought leader and coveted keynote speaker and educator. He has traveled the world headlining international conferences and teaching inspiring lessons about animal aggression, animal behavior, and industry trends. Please welcome Dr. Chris Pockel. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on today. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm always excited when I get to talk to a vet behaviorist because there are so few of you guys. And when you spend the time to talk to us, it means a lot. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. There's, you know, I sort of almost see it as a responsibility because there are so few of us that when the opportunities come up to get that information out there, I'm happy to accept.
Yeah. And so I recently did an episode about, you know, just so people would understand what it's like to work with a veterinary behaviorist, kind of what to expect, because if you have a more severe case and you're working with a trainer, they might recommend or your vet might recommend that you reach out to a vet behaviorist. But I just wanted to say, since they tend to be more, I don't know if the word extreme or severe, I don't know what the good terminology to use it is, but it's not every case, obviously, that needs a veterinary behaviorist. But when you do, you can expect it sort of to be a longer resolution rather than a shorter one, I think.
Yeah, I think that's generally going to be the case. You know, and what I always try to remember, though, too, is, you know, ultimately the pet parent or the caregiver is the one who determines who they seek out for help or support. So I say that being in Portland here, we've got a couple of different behavior practices actually where clients have the opportunity to seek out help a bit more expediently. And so we actually do end up seeing some simpler cases or those cases where clients perhaps recognize that the toolbox of the vet behaviorist is uniquely qualified for whatever questions they're trying to get answered. And so we actually see a pretty significant spectrum of cases that does, of course, include some of the more challenging ones. But I wouldn't want someone to assume that just because they're going to a vet behaviorist, they're automatically signing up for a long process. But that's going to be something that's probably going to come up within that first consult as we get a kind of a better picture of what's going on for that particular animal.
Okay, well, that's good to know. What is there such a thing as an average length of the cases that you work, or
no.
Everybody's individual?
No, I wish that were the case to some degree, but it's what I'll often tell my clients is, you know, we start out, you know, we kind of put one foot in front of the other, and you know, we'll do an initial assessment, we'll figure out what's doable from that point. And then we do it, and then we recheck, and we see how much progress we've achieved based on that plan. And that's what lets us know, okay, if we've got a huge, huge amount of work that's left to be done, and we accomplished, let's say, 8% of our progress over 3 months of dedicated work, well, we can kind of carry out that trajectory and start to predict a bit more of what that overall process is going to look like. But by the same token, there are other cases where we do an assessment, we make a couple of key changes, and we come back for a 10 to 12 week recheck, and the owner says, gosh, like, I think I'm good.
Awesome.
So that happens too, right? I never want to go into it assuming that's going to be the case, but there's a lot of different ways that those outcomes could turn out based on what's actually going on for the animal.
That's awesome. What are the types of cases that tend to take the longest to resolve?
I think the ones that we're seeing right now in particular are those that involve multiple factors. And by that, I mean there's often a physical component, whether that's unresolved or unregulated gastrointestinal or GI tract stuff. In some cases, we may have overlapping neurologic conditions or other endocrine or hormonal issues like thyroid disease or some of the steroid hormone conditions that, you know, they're just trickier to tease out, right? It's not just one factor. And then, of course, anything that causes chronic pain creates a longer course of treatment in most cases because those things tend to wax and wane. We have good days, we have not so good days. And so it's often a bit of a learning curve as we're figuring out that particular animal's signals, how to read them, how to support them, and then how to modify our plan based on how they're responding over time, even as they get older.
Yeah. What would you like pet parents to know, like at the beginning? Is there something that you sort of tell everybody when they come in?
Not really. I mean, I guess I'm a huge fan of expectation setting, you know, as best we can. And so I try to let my clients know that when they're coming in for that first appointment, that appointment in and of itself typically has three components. They're going to give me the sort of the initial portion, which is me gathering information about what's going on. And then we're going to transition to a period where I can share my perspective on the case. And then together, we're going to plan whatever that treatment or that intervention plan is going to look like. So, you know, beyond that, exactly what happens in each of those components is going to be really, really different. Some cases are very, very hands-on. They're very much involved with training and seeing how that animal learns and how flexible they are. And others, either because of safety or significant anxiety issues, it's really hands-off. And we're just kind of, you know, allowing that animal to be present in this space while we're discussing our options based on that animal's history. And then we're going to be kind of working a bit in a bit more nuanced way over time to really tease out the plan.
How do people know if they're moving in the right direction?
I would say that the easiest way to know if they're moving in the right direction is that they're seeing progress. And that's sort of a kind of a tongue-in-cheek answer almost, but it's the truth, right? If we're on the right track, behavior change happens fast. Now, I'm not saying going from severe problem to resolution happens fast, but we should be able to see, for example, if I'm working with a patient who has anxiety conditions and maybe we're working on a skill set around relaxation exercises, I should be able to track that animal's progress within a particular training session. And even between training sessions or between recheck appointments in my office, we should be able to see progress and know that that animal is learning new skills or that those skills that we are practicing are becoming more and more accessible. If it feels like we're spinning our wheels or putting a lot of work in, but not able to measure any degree of progress back, then something's probably off track or just not quite dialed in yet. And that might be that we need to make a medication change. It may be that there are, again, medical issues that we've not fully accounted for yet. But we should be able to feel like we're making progress. And that would be a big red flag for me, for one of my clients, if they say, man, I'm doing a whole lot of stuff and I'm getting nowhere. Mm-hmm. That's a red flag for me.
Yeah. Let's circle around this a little bit because this is a big point for me when I'm working with clients, because sometimes emotionally we feel like we're not making progress when we are. Yes. And so trying to teach people to see behavior as data and learn how to track it and quantify it in certain ways, it, I think, is really important, so that we can see the progress that we are making. It's difficult if you're not talking about a specific behavior, because each type of behavior would have a different set of data. But, you know, for instance, like separation anxiety, it's tracked a lot in time, right? How many seconds, how many minutes is that animal comfortable when they're alone? But there's ways to track behavior and get data out of that behavior for other instances as well. And I think that's important for people. Do you make that part of what you teach people? Be like, this is what we're looking at. This is how I want you to think about it. Do you rate severity from like 1 to 5?
Yeah, I think your point about it looking different for every single case is a really valid one, right? Whether we're talking about a separation anxiety case, whether we're thinking about a dog who is lunging and barking at other dogs on the neighborhood walks, or whether we're thinking about a cat, for example, who is urinating outside of the litter box, mm-hmm. right? Some of those are very episodic problems. Others we might encounter multiple times per day. Others might be rare. Some are public facing, some are private, some are, you know, there's so many different variables. But I think what sort of connects all of them is that it's important to have a conversation, even a short one, about what would or what might progress actually look like.
Yes.
And so many times, and I almost said I'm guilty of this. I don't want to bring guilt into the conversation. I trend in this direction myself as well, of basically saying, well, I've identified my problem, right? My dog is lunging and barking at other dogs.
Sure.
Success would be the problem no longer happens, right? Like. Yeah. And we tend to look at it in kind of this 1-0 black, white, yes, no sort of kind of, you know, false dichotomy almost, where it's like there's a whole lot of gray in between there. And so mm-hmm. I think having an honest conversation about whatever the pattern is and, you know, teasing out this leash reactive or, you know, barking, lunging dog as a good example here, we might see progress in that the animal may be better able to hear dogs barking from a block away without immediately reacting. Mm-hmm. Or we may have a dog who can hear a dog bark, but then is still able to eat food or is still able to respond to a cue like hand targeting or look at me or let's go in another direction, whatever the cue happens to be. And so we could measure progress, not because the dog did or did not lunge and bark, but maybe they're quicker to recover. So they're now turning away and giving a full body shake off within 7 steps rather than having to get half a block away from that other dog before they even started to recover. So I'm often looking at the dog in front of me and saying, hey, what does this dog look like when it alerts, when it reacts, when it recovers? What are some of the things that I can call out, not only so that my owners and my caregivers are able to recognize those same things that I'm seeing, but then they're actually able to report that back, whether it's through a phone call or a Zoom check-in or sending a spreadsheet in via email, they're able to give me concrete data rather than impressions. Impressions are important. But if I'm going to be trying to decide whether a medication is working or whether we need to change our behavior modification protocol, I need the data to go along with those impressions.
Absolutely. I think that's a huge conversation I have with my clients the first time that we meet, you know, teaching them how to see the behavior as data and track it. But it's hard for us. It's hard because it can be tedious, right? You just described a lot of factors like distance and whether it was audio or visual stimulus. And, you know, the recovery time and all kinds of things, right? And so it can be overwhelming to try to track each individual piece of it. But I think it's just really important at the very least to start being aware, because if your dog barks and lunges, if we say that, barks and lunges on the leash and it keeps happening, you're like, oh, it's not working. But if you're not noticing that it used to be 10 times on the block and now it's 2, or that dog is much further away when they started lunging than it is this time. You know, it's really easy to get stuck in that, oh, we're not making any progress when you are. So even if you're not tracking it, writing it down, just being aware of it, so important.
Yes. And that's something that comes up for me too, as a vet behaviorist, when I'm taking referrals from veterinary teams as well, that when I'm asking the client, let's say that the primary care veterinarian prescribed a medication, and when I ask the client, well, how did it work? What did you observe? And I'll often get a response, you know, it either worked or it helped or it didn't. And again, we're back to this sort of, you know, 1-0 black white. And that's actually pretty rare in medication therapy for a for a single medication to have such a dramatic effect that right. it either resolves the problem or not. More likely, it's improving the animal's ability to regulate their emotional response to that situation, or perhaps speeding up their recovery, or, you know, reducing their sensitivity to some of those emotional factors. But that's harder, right? It's harder to evaluate unless somebody has given you some insight as to what that progress could look like. And again, whether it's behavior mod, whether it's management, whether it's medication, it's all an important part of the process.
If you'd like more of Dr. Pockel, his website, www.drpockel.com, that's DrPachel, is linked for you in the show notes. We'll be right back. What can you do to help people avoid getting burnt out and giving up if this is going to be a long issue? You know, separation anxiety, for instance, can take months and months and months to resolve. Reactivity and aggression can be very, very long cases. How do you keep people from giving up?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of really important pieces there. And some of it starts from the beginning with some realistic expectations. And I love the fact that you mentioned a separation anxiety case. I was just having a conversation with Milena DiMartini here in the last week or so. And I love the way that she said this. She said, when we're getting a client started with a separation anxiety protocol, I want them thinking in terms of months rather than weeks. But I also want them thinking in terms of months, not years. And so, you know, we're kind of trying to have this idea that it's going to take some time, it's going to take some work, but hopefully it's not something that's going to stretch out over the majority of your animal's lifespan, right? Mm. Hopefully we'll be able to make progress a whole lot faster than that. So part of it is trying to forecast as best we can what we think that process is going to look like. And to some degree, I'll even let my clients know right from the start that I think every single one of my clients gets frustrated with the process at some point in time, because that's kind of normal.
Yeah.
Right? It's not going to be linear. We're going to have some good days. We're going to have some bad days. So to some degree, yes, setting expectations, but also normalizing the frustrations so mm-hmm. that when that happens, it's not coming out of left field. I don't have a client who's now thinking, oh my gosh, I'm such a terrible pet parent. You know, all I have to do are these simple exercises and I'm so frustrated. And gosh, some days I might not even like my dog all that much because of how much work I'm having to put in or how frustrating this is. And all of that can actually be pretty normal. So
yeah.
I think normalizing the process, and in some cases we try to help those clients establish a sense of community so that they realize that they're not alone.
That's great.
This process of actually going through this and working through whatever it is that they're trying to address is a process that other folks are going through as well. And, you know, that really doesn't fix the frustration, but again, it helps to normalize, it helps to reduce some of that isolation that can happen, you know, whether we're talking about that dog who's lunging and barking, and so our circle of friends may be really small, or maybe it's the dog with separation anxiety, and we can't go out for dinner with friends and meet up the way we'd like to because we have to be with our dog. Or maybe it's, you know, I mentioned the cat who's urinating outside of the litter box. Maybe we're embarrassed to invite people into our home because it kind of smells like cat pee some days. Mm-hmm. You know, all of those things can be really alienating and really isolating. And so I want my clients to know, yeah, when you get frustrated, at the very least, let me know about it. Not saying I can fix it. I'm truthfully, I'm not here to be your therapist. That's above my pay grade. But I can acknowledge that. I can hear you. And if there are things that would bring to our treatment plan that may allow us to adjust or pull in other sources of support, gosh, I'd love the opportunity to be able to do that. So let me know what's going on for you, and we'll see what we can tweak along the way.
What a great idea. Yeah. So we're talking about making progress, you know, getting support. All of this involves the hope that there is a light at the end of the tunnel and that there will be a positive resolution to the case. Is there always a positive resolution to the case?
That's such a great question. I would argue that the majority of the time there's a positive outcome to the case. but I'm sort of trying to choose my words really carefully here, because it doesn't always look the way we think it would. And, yeah. you know, and in some cases, you know, with some straightforward interventions, we're able to teach that animal a different way of responding to their stressors. And so success looks exactly like we thought it would look. In other cases, success might be us coming to terms with what might be a realistic outcome for that animal because of their behavioral history, their trauma history, or maybe there's some medical stuff going on that we're just not going to be able to fix. And so success isn't really resolution, but more a level of acceptance. And I like the word acceptance rather than being sort of resigned to it. And there's often a shift that happens for my clients when they reach a point where they can say, yeah, you know, I can see that my dog is trying, and this is as good as she can do right now. And I accept that. And I will continue to work to help him or her learn how to improve, but I can also meet them where they are. And when we reach a point of acceptance, and again, I'm not saying this is as good as it gets, you just got to tough it out and accept it here. But meeting that animal where they are and helping them along the way through that point of acceptance, often I feel a whole lot more lightness in the overall care when I can see that happen. But I also know, having done this, gosh, you know, over multiple decades now at this point in time for thousands and thousands of cases, that acceptance isn't something that we can necessarily force. It's going to look a little bit different for every client. You know, and I also have to remember that in some cases, success really doesn't feel like success at all. And that means in some of the really challenging cases where there may be a safety concern, you know, or a welfare concern due to significant fear or anxiety, where we're actually creating quality of life conversations, that, you know, a successful, quote unquote, successful outcome may, in some rare cases or some less common cases, actually involve finding a different home for that animal, or an even less commonly, perhaps even choosing humane euthanasia due to safety or welfare concerns. And gosh, those almost never feel like success in the moment. Right. Yeah. And yet a lot of my clients tell me later on, that was the right thing to do for us. It was hard to see at the time, hard to feel at the time, but in the long run, that was what we needed to do. So in its own sort of different way, that even that could be considered success. So yeah. It's very, very different from one case to the next.
Absolutely. I'm glad you said that. And I want people who are listening to this to know that, you know, we're here to help you make those hard decisions. You know, we wish that life with animals didn't have these situations, but
yeah.
The truth is that they do. And, you know, it can be ostracizing and make people feel guilty, but sometimes you're right. It's absolutely the right thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And one more question. It can be expensive to work with a veterinary behaviorist, and especially if it's ongoing and it's a long case with many visits. Not everybody can afford that. What happens if you've got one of the pets that really, ideally, that's what they need, but truly you just can't afford it? Are there other resources available?
Yeah, it's. I'm glad you brought up the cost issue, because, you know, with any specialized care, whether it's behavioral care, whether it's a, you know, an orthopedic surgery that your animal would really benefit from, or, you know, whatever it happens to be, right? So specialized care can be really expensive, and that means that it's not going to be universally available to every single pet owner, regardless of whether we want it to be or not. It's just not where we are right now in terms of that industry. And so, you know, a couple of things that I think are relevant here. One is, do the best you can with the resource you have available to you, and try to, you know, listen to podcasts like this one to try to make sure you're making the best decisions possible, versus, you know, spinning your wheels, potentially spending those valuable resources in ways that, well, may not get you closer to your goals. So I think that's part of it. I would also put in a little bit of a plug here for health insurance for pets, meaning that some of the programs, not all of them, but some of them do cover behavioral care and behavioral therapy as well. And when I'm working with a client who recognizes that, you know, that they need that long-term plan that you're mentioning, and they have insurance that covers it. Gosh, it's so, so rewarding to see that look on their face, knowing that they're going to be able to make the decisions for the care of that animal that are not based on what they can afford in that moment, but rather we're going to be able to move forward because the coverage exists. So yeah. Insurance is there as well. Again, I know that's also not available to everyone. Sometimes, you know, the issues are already present before we even think about that as an option. That gets us into pre-existing coverage discussions and all of that stuff. That's way more than what we're going to get into here today. But the third piece that I would mention here would then be, you know, trying to find those resources that are within your price point, you know, while we're having this specific financial conversation. And you know, not only are there a lot of podcasts like this one that are completely free to listen to, there's also some really good resources available through social media and through different web pages, different online courses that is absolutely free to users. Now, the caveat here is there's also a lot of really terrible information out there as well.
I was going to say it. You have to be careful where you get your free information for sure.
Absolutely. Just because someone's got a flashy website does not mean that they're necessarily a trusted resource, or that TikTok sensation who's, you know, given snappy little sound bites may have good information, but it's not a guarantee.
Yeah.
So, you know, really thinking about some of the, I'm going to say some of the credentialed organizations or credentialing organizations, ones like the International Association of Animal Behavior Consultants or the IAABC, that organization, as an example, has a list of their members on the website. So you might even, again, if you're trying to leverage limited resources, you may start out by going down that path of looking up those member names and doing a search on Instagram, who's got a really informative channel and the credentials to back up the information. It's more legwork, but if you've got the time but not the financial resources, that may be a way that you can really tap into some phenomenal, phenomenal resources. You know, and I'll mention certain things as well that, you know, in addition to the work that I do at the Animal Behavior Clinic, I'm also on the leadership team for Instinct Dog Behavior and Training. We've got locations in 11 markets around the continental U.S. at this point in time, and we've got free resources available on our website, including courses on leash reactivity, patient and polite household manners issues. We've got a course on kids and dogs, you know, things like that. Those courses are available. So work with folks who you know are putting good content out that's available for your consumption and implementation.
Awesome. Awesome advice. And I will put the link to that site in the show notes for sure for everybody.
Awesome.
Thank you. That was amazing. Is there anything else you want to make sure that you get a chance to say before we sign off?
You know, I think the take home message for me around this topic of, you know, challenging cases and, you know, and being in it for the long haul is, you know, give yourself some grace in the process too. This stuff is hard.
Yeah.
This stuff is hard. I would love for it to be easy. I would love for it to be fast. The reality is most of the time that's not necessarily going to be the path forward. So, you know, acknowledge those feelings and, you know, do the best you can to continue plugging forward with the resources that you have available to you in your unique situation. And, you know, find yourself some grace because, again, you love that critter that's in your home, right? You're doing the best you can. That's an important thing to come back to.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on today. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you for stopping by the dojo this week. This is your aspiring sensei, Susan Light, signing off. You can find me at doggydojopodcast.com or I'm Susan Light LA on Instagram, Pinterest, and Facebook. The music was written by Mac Light. You can find him at maclightsongwriter.com. If you like the show, you can support it by subscribing, sharing it with your friends, rating it, and reviewing it on Apple Podcasts. Just a reminder, this podcast is intended for educational purposes only and does not constitute advice or professional services by either the host or any of the guests. I'll be back in 2 weeks with another new episode of the Doggy Dojo. Thank you.